This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Spell of the Highlander by Karen Marie Mauney, performed by Phil Giganti. Synchronicity. 1. The simultaneous occurrence of two or more meaningfully but not causally connected events. 2. The coinciding or alignment of forces in the universe to create an event or circumstance. 3. A collision of possible so incalculably improbable that it would appear to imply divine intervention. First Prologue. Avil, Queen of the Fae, stood in the catacombs beneath the Belfew building, concealed by countless layers of illusion, a formless projection of herself beyond any she-seer's vision, beyond even her own race's perception. In the dimly lit labyrinthine tombs, Adam Black was pacing furiously, holding his ears and cursing a wailing Chloe Zanders. But it was not Adam's plight that concerned her now. It was her own. Tonight she'd wielded the formidable magic of the Queen of the Tuatha De Dona to destroy the druid sect of the Dragaar. But it was not for that purpose alone she'd done it. As ever, she had motives within motives. Her use of the full power of the High Queen of the Seely Court of the Light had caused a blackout of all mortal magic throughout Britain, part of Scotland, and a fair portion of Wales. It had shattered wards humans believed unbreakable, voided protection spells, and temporarily leached all sacred mortal relics of any power they possessed. Closing her eyes, Avil turned her far vision outward, analyzing the weft and weck of the fabric of her world. She'd pulled a thread here, tugged a thread there, and the infinitesimal changes she sought had begun. Somewhere in Tibet, an ancient sorcerer was seeking the unholiest of dark hallows. Somewhere in London, a thief was casing a wealthy residence reputed to contain unimaginable treasures within. Somewhere, a Keltar was biding his time, waiting for a vengeance long overdue. Ah, yes, it had begun. Second Prologue. Some men are born under a lucky star. Showered with female attention from the moment of his highly anticipated birth into a family of 7 lovely wee Keltar lasses, but alas, no sons. His da dead to a hunting accident a fortnight earlier. Kian McKelter came into the world, at 10 pounds 3 ounces, already laird of the castle. Heady stuff for such a wee bairn. As he matured into a man, he inherited the typical Keltar looks, wide-shouldered and powerful, all rippling muscle, topped by the dark, savagely beautiful face of an avenging angel. His noble Celt bloodline, true to its aggressive warrior aristocracy heritage, also bequeathed him a lion's share of sexuality, a simmering, scarce-contained eroticism that shaped his very walk, underscored his every move. At 10, Kian McKelter was the sun, the moon, and the stars. And he knew it. He was a druid to boot. And unlike the vast majority of his broody, overly serious ancestors, not to mention the veritable plethora of broody ones yet to be born, he liked being a druid, liked everything about it. He liked the power that hummed so potently in his veins. He liked cozying up with a flask of whiskey among the collection of ancient lore and artifacts in the underground chamber library of Castle Keltar, studying the arcane knowledge, combining a chancy spell with a risky potion, growing stronger and more powerful. He liked walking the heathery hills after a storm, saying the ancient words to heal the land and the wee beasties. He liked performing the rites of the seasons, chanting beneath a fat, orange harvest moon, with a fierce highland wind tangling his long dark hair, and fanning his sacred fires into pillars of flame, knowing that the all-powerful Tuatha De Dona depended upon him. He liked bedding the lasses, taking their sweet lushness beneath his hard body, using his druid arts to give them such wild, mindless pleasure as, it was whispered, only an exotic fae lover could bestow. He even liked the brush of fear with which much of his world regarded him, as a Keltar druid and heir to the ancient, terrifying magic of the Old Ones. The laird responsible for the continuation of the sacred Keltar legacy in the late 9th century was devilishly charming, darkly seductive, and the most powerful Keltar druid ever to live. None naysayed, none challenged, none ever bested Cian MacKeltar. Verily, the possibility that someone or something one day might never even occurred to him. Until that cursed Samhain of his 30th year. Some men are born under a lucky star. Cian MacKeltar was not one of them. Shortly thereafter, the underground chamber library was sealed off, never to be mentioned again, and all record of Cian MacKeltar was stricken from the Keltar written annals. It is highly debated among surviving Keltar progeny whether or not this controversial ancestor ever even existed. And none know that now, some 1,100 years later, Cian MacKeltar still lives. Sort of. In a hellish manner of speaking. Part 1. Chicago. Chapter 1. Friday, October 6th. The call that changed the entire course of Jesse St. James's life came on an utterly unremarkable, dateless Friday night that differed in no particularly significant way from any other unremarkable, dateless Friday night in her all-too-predictable life, which, she was in no hurry to discuss, were a lot of Friday nights. She was sitting in the dark on the fire escape outside the kitchen window of her third-floor apartment at 222 Elizabeth Street, enjoying an unseasonably warm autumn evening. She was being a shameless voyeur, peeping around the corner of the brownstone to watch a crowd of people that, unlike her, had time to have a life, and were talking and laughing out on the sidewalk in front of the nightclub across the street. For the past few minutes, she'd been riveted by a leggy redhead and her boyfriend, a dark-haired, sun-bronzed, muscled hottie in jeans and a white T-shirt. He kept backing his girlfriend up against the wall, stretching her hands above her head and kissing her like there was no tomorrow, getting into it with his whole gorgeous, rippling body. And would you just look at that hip action, the way he was grinding against her, they might as well be doing it right there in the street. Jesse sucked in a sharp breath. God, had she ever been kissed like that? Like the man couldn't wait to get inside her? Like he wanted to devour her, maybe crawl right inside her skin? The redhead's hand slipped free, down to the hottie's ass, fingers curving into his muscled butt, and Jesse's hands curled into fists. When the hottie's hands skimmed up the redhead's breasts, his thumbs grazing her nipples, Jesse's own went hard as little pearls. She could almost imagine she was the one he was kissing, that she was the one he was about to have hot, animalistic. Why can't I have a life like that? She thought. You can, an inner voice reminded, after your PhD. The reminder wasn't nearly as effective as it had been years ago as an undergrad. She was sick of being in school, sick of being broke, sick of constantly racing from her classes to her full-time job as Professor Keene's assistant, then home to study, or, if she was really lucky, snatching a whopping 4 or 5 hours of sleep before getting up to do it all over again. Her demanding, tightly organized schedule left no time for a social life, and lately she'd been feeling downright sulky about it. Everywhere she turned lately, there were couples, and they were busy coupling and having a wonderfully couplicious time of it. But not her. There was no time for coupling in her life. She wasn't one of the lucky ones that had a free ride through school. She had to scrimp and save and make every moment and penny count. In addition to working full-time and taking a full load of classes, she taught classes too. It barely left her time to eat, shower, and sleep. On the infrequent occasions she'd tried to date, the guys had gotten so fed up with how seldom she could see them and how low on her list of priorities they seemed to be, and how unwilling she was to fall right in bed with them. Most college guys seemed to think if they didn't score by the third date, there was something wrong with the woman, Police, that they'd soon sought greener pastures. Still, it would all be worth it soon. Although some people didn't seem to think being an archaeologist and playing with old, dusty, or frequently dead things for the rest of one's life was a particularly exciting thing to do. Like her mom, who hated Jessie's choice of major and couldn't understand why she wasn't married and blissfully popping out babies like her sisters, Jessie couldn't imagine a more thrilling career. It might not top other people's lists of dreams, but it was hers. Dr. Jessica St. James. She was so close she could taste it. Another year and a half and she'd be done with her coursework for her Ph.D. Then she might date like the Energizer Bunny, making up for lost time. But right now, she'd not worked so hard and gone into so much debt to go screwing everything up just because she seemed to be stuck in some kind of hormonal overdrive. In a few years, she consoled herself, staring down at the busy street. The people hanging out at that club would probably still be hanging out at that club, their lives completely unchanged, while she would be traveling to far-off places, digging up remnants of the past, and having grand adventures. And who knew? Maybe Mr. Wright would be waiting for her out there at some future dig site. Maybe her life just wasn't scheduled to take off as fast as everyone else's. Maybe she was just a late bloomer. Holy cow. The hottie was slipping his hand inside the redhead's jeans, and her hand was on his... Oh, right there in front of God and everybody. Behind her, somewhere in the cramped and crowded apartment that desperately needed to be cleaned and have the trash taken out, the phone began to ring. Jessie rolled her eyes. The mundaneness of her existence always chose the most inconvenient moments to intrude. Ring. Ring. She gulped another fascinated look at the unabashed display of sex on the sidewalk, then reluctantly boosted herself inside the kitchen window. She shook her head in a vain attempt to clear it, then pulled down the shade. What she couldn't see couldn't torture her. At least not much, anyway. Ring! Where was that blasted phone? She finally spied it on the sofa, nearly buried beneath pillows, candy wrappers, and a pizza box that contained... Ew, something fuzzy and phosphorescent green. As she gingerly pushed aside the box, she hesitated, hand suspended in midair above the phone. For a moment, the briefest, most peculiar of interludes, she suffered the inexplicable, intense feeling that she shouldn't pick it up. That she should just let it ring and ring. Maybe let it ring all weekend. Later, Jessie would recall that feeling. Time itself seemed to stand still for that odd, pregnant slice of time, and she had the weirdest sensation that the universe itself had stopped breathing and was waiting to see what she would do next. She wrinkled her nose at the ridiculous, egocentric thought. As if the universe ever even noticed Jessie St. James. She picked up the phone. Lucan Mirin Trevane paced before the fire. When employing a sorcerer's spell to conceal his true appearance, which he did whenever he wasn't completely alone, he was tall, in his early 40s, handsome, powerfully built, his thick black hair dashed at the temples with silver. He was a man who turned women's heads and made men take an instinctive step back when he walked by. His mien said one thing: power. I have it. You don't. And if you think you do, try me. His features were old world, his eyes cold gray as a lock beneath a stormy sky. His true appearance was far less appealing. He'd amassed tremendous wealth and power in his lifetime, which had been considerably longer than most. He held controlling interest in many and varied enterprises, from banks to media to oil. He kept residences in a dozen cities. He retained a select group of uniquely trained men and the occasional woman to handle his most private affairs. To his left, seated in a deep armchair, one of those men waited tensely. "This is absurd, Roman." Lucan growled. What the hell's taking so long? Roman shifted defensively in his chair. He was aptly named, his features as classically handsome as those on an ancient coin, his hair long and blonde.
I've got men on it, Mr. Trevane,
he said with the trace of a Russian accent.
The best men we've got. The problem is, they went in a dozen different directions. They were sold on the black market. No one has names. It's going to take time.
Time is the one thing I don't have. Lucan cut him off sharply.
Every hour, every moment that passes makes it less likely they'll be recovered. Those damned things must be found.
Those damned things were the dark or unseelie hallows of the Tuatha De Dananna. Artifacts of immense power created by an ancient civilization that had passed, centuries ago and quite erroneously, into man's history books as a mythical race. The Daoyin Shi, or the Fae. Lucan had believed there was no better place to safekeep his prized treasures than in his well-warded private residence in London. He'd been wrong. Critically wrong. He wasn't certain what had happened a few months ago while he'd been out of the country pursuing a lead on the Dark Book, the final and most powerful of the four unseelie hallows. But something had transpired somewhere in London, its epicenter in the east side. He could feel the lingering traces of power that had reverberated through all of England. An immense and ancient power had risen for a brief time, so strong that it had neutralized all other magic in Britain, which he wouldn't have cared about since whatever it was had departed as swiftly as it had come, except for the fact that its rising had shattered formidable, allegedly unbreakable wards that protected his most prized possessions. Protected them so well that he'd found the notion of a modern-day security system laughable. Not so laughable now. He'd had a state-of-the-art system installed, with cameras in every room, sweeping every angle, because while he'd been away, a thief had broken into his museum of a home and stolen artifacts that had belonged to him for centuries, including his irreplaceable hallows, the box, amulet, and mirror. Fortunately, the thief had been spotted by neighbors while hauling away his loot. Unfortunately, by the time Lucan's select staff had managed to identify and track the bastard, he'd already sold the artifacts to the first in a series of elusive middlemen. Artifacts such as his, fabulous and utterly lacking provenance, inevitably ended up in one of two places, with the legal authorities of one country or another after being intercepted in transit, or sold for a fraction of their worth on the black market before disappearing. Sometimes for hundreds of years before so much as a whispered rumor was heard of them again. They'd gotten few names, and those, obvious aliases, from the thief before he'd died. For months now, Lucan's men had been chasing a deliberately and cunningly muddied trail, and time was growing critical.
Though we've recovered three of the manuscripts and one of the swords, we've learned nothing about the box or amulet. But it looks like we might have a solid lead on the mirror,
Roman was saying. Lucan stiffened. The mirror. The dark glass was the one hallow he needed urgently. Of all the years it might have been stolen, it had had to be this one, when the tithe was due. The other dark hallows could wait a bit longer, though not long. They were far too dangerous to have loose in the world. Each of the hallows conferred a gift upon its possessor for a price, if the possessor had the knowledge and the power to use it. The mirror's dark gift was immortality, so long as he met its conditions. He'd been meeting its conditions for over 1,000 years now. He intended to continue.
A shipment rumored to fit the bill left England for the States via Ireland a few days ago. We believe it's headed for some university in Chicago.
Then why the fuck are you still sitting here? Lucan said coldly. If you have a lead, any lead at all, on the glass, I want you on it personally. Now!
It was imperative he recover that mirror before Samhain. Or else.
That "or else" was a thing he refused to contemplate. The mirror would be found, the tithe paid.
A small quantity of pure gold passed through the glass every 100 years, in the old one's way of marking time, which was more than a century by modern standards, at precisely midnight on Samhain, or Halloween as the current century called it. 26 days from today the century's tithe was due. 26 days from today the mirror must be in his possession, or the compact binding his captive to it would be broken. As the blond man gathered his coat and gloves, Lucan reiterated his position where the Dark Hallows were concerned. "No, witnesses Roman, anyone who's caught so much as even a glimpse of one of the Hallows."
Roman inclined his head in silent concurrence. Lucan said no more. There was no need. Roman knew how he liked things handled, as did all who worked for him, and continued to live.
Some time later, shortly after midnight, Jesse was back on campus for the third time that day in the south wing of the archaeology department, unlocking Professor Keene's office. She wondered wryly why she even bothered leaving. Given the hours she kept, she'd be better off tucking a cot into that stuffy, forgotten janitor's closet down the hall, amid mops and brooms and pails that hadn't been used in years. She'd not only get more sleep, she'd save on gas money, too. When the professor had called her from the hospital to tell her that he'd been in a bit of a fender bender on his way back to campus,
"A few inconvenient fractures and contusions, not to worry,"
he'd assured her swiftly. She'd been expecting him to ask her to pick up his classes for the next few days, meaning her sleep window would dwindle from 4 or 5 hours to a great big fat nil. But he'd informed her he'd already called Mark Trudeau and arranged for him to take his classes until he returned.
"I've a wee favor to ask of you, though, Jessica. I've a package coming. I was to accept a delivery at my office this evening,"
he told her in his deep voice that, even after 25 years away from County Louth, Ireland, had never lost its lilt. She loved that lilt. Couldn't wait to one day hear a whole pub speaking it while she washed down a hearty serving of soda bread and Irish stew with a perfectly poured Guinness. After, of course, having spent an entire day in the National Museum of Ireland, delightedly poring over such fabulous treasures as the Tara Brooch, the Arda Chalice, and the Broiter Gold Collection. Hugging the phone between ear and shoulder, she glanced at her watch, the luminous dial indicating 10 minutes past 10.
"What kind of package gets delivered so late at night?"
she'd wondered aloud.
"You needn't concern yourself with that. Just sign for it, lock it up, and go home. That's all I need."
"Of course, Professor, but what—"
"Just sign, lock it up, and forget about it, Jessica."
A pause, a weighty silence, then,
"I see no reason to mention this to anyone. It's personal, not university business."
She blinked, startled. She'd never heard such a tone in the professor's voice before. Words sharply clipped. He'd sounded defensive, almost, well, paranoid.
"I understand. I'll take care of it. You just rest, Professor. Don't you worry about a thing,"
she'd soothed hastily, deciding that whatever pain meds he was getting were making him funny, the poor dear. She'd once had Tylenol with codeine that had made her feel itchy all over, short-tempered and irritable. With multiple fractures, it was a sure bet he'd been given something stronger than Tylenol 3. Now, standing beneath the faintly buzzing fluorescent lights in the university hallway, she rubbed her eyes and yawned hugely. She was exhausted. She'd gotten up at 6:15 for a 7:20 class, and by the time she got home tonight, this morning, and managed to fall back into bed, she would have put in another 20-hour day. Again. Turning the key in the lock, she pushed open the office door, fumbled for the light switch, and flipped it on. She inhaled as she stepped into the professor's office, savoring the scholarly blend of books and leather, fine wood polish, and the pungent aroma of his favorite pipe tobacco. She planned to one day have an office of her own, very much like it. The spacious room had built-in floor-to-ceiling bookcases and tall windows that, during the day, spilled sun across an intricately woven antique rug of wine, russet, and amber. The teak and mahogany furniture was formally masculine. A stately clawfoot desk,
a sumptuous leather Chesterfield sofa in a deep burnished coffee bean hue, companion wing chairs. There were numerous glass-paned curio cabinets and occasional tables displaying his most prized replica pieces. A reproduction Tiffany lamp graced his desk. Only his computer, with its 21-inch flat screen, belied the century. Remove it, and she might have been standing in the library of a 19th-century English manor house. "In here!" she called over her shoulder to the deliveryman. The package hadn't turned out to be quite what she'd expected. From the way the professor had spoken of it, she'd imagined a bulky envelope, perhaps a small parcel. But the package was actually a crate, and a huge one at that. It was tall, wide, about the size of a sarcophagus or something, and proving no easy matter to navigate through the university corridors.
"Careful, man! Tilt it! Tilt it! Ah, you're smashing my finger! Back it up and angle it!"
I muttered,
"Sorry."
More grunting.
"Damn thing's awkward. Hall's too friggin' narrow."
"You're almost here," Jesse offered helpfully. "Just a bit farther."
Indeed, moments later, they were carefully lowering the oblong box from their shoulders, depositing it on the rug.
"The professor said I needed to sign something."
She encouraged them to hurry. She had a full day of working and studying tomorrow. Today.
"Lady, we need more than that. This here package don't get left till it's verified."
"Verified?" she echoed. "What does that mean?"
"Means it's worth buku bucks, and the shipper's insurer gotta have visual verification and release, see? Says so right here."
The beefier of the two thrust a clipboard at her.
"Don't care who does it, lady, so long as somebody's John Hancock's on my paperwork."
Sure enough, "Visual verification and release required" was stamped in red across the bill of lading, followed by 2 pages of terms and definitions detailing shippers' and buyers' rights in pedantic, inflated legal jargon. She pushed a hand through her short, dark curls, sighing. The professor wasn't going to like this. He'd said it was personal.
"And if I don't let you open it up and inspect it?"
"Goes back, lady. And let me tell you, the shipper's gonna be plenty pissed."
"Yeah," said the other man. "Thing cost an arm and a leg to insure. Goes back, your professor's gonna have to pay the second time around. I bet he's gonna be plenty pissed, too."
They stared at her with flat, challenging gazes, clearly disinclined to wrestle the awkward crate back up on their shoulders, squeeze it back down the hall, reload it, and return it, only to end up delivering it again. They weren't even talking to her breasts, a thing men often did, especially the first time they met her, which told her how deadly earnest they were about dumping their load and getting on with their lives. She glanced at the phone. She glanced at her watch. She hadn't gotten the professor's room number and suspected that if she called the main desk, they'd never put her through at this hour. Though he'd insisted he wasn't badly hurt, she knew the doctors wouldn't have kept him if he hadn't been seriously injured. Hospitals these days spit people out as fast as they took them in. Would the professor be more upset if she opened it, or if she refused the delivery and it cost him a fortune to have it reshipped? She sighed again, feeling damned if she did and damned if she didn't. In the end, it was the constantly broke college student in her who flipped the coin and made the call.
"Fine. Let's do this. Open it up."
20 minutes later, the deliveryman had secured her wearily scribbled signature and were gone, taking the remains of the crating with them. And now she stood, eyeing the thing curiously. It wasn't a sarcophagus after all. In fact, most of the packaging had been padding. From deep within layers and layers of cushioned wrapping, they'd unearthed a mirror, and at her direction, propped it carefully against the east wall of bookshelves. Taller than she by more than a foot, the mirror's ornate frame was a shimmery gold. Shapes and symbols, of such uniformity and cohesion to imply a system of writing, were carved into every inch of the wide border. She narrowed her eyes, pondering the etchings, but linguistics was not her specialty, and the symbols were nothing that, without searching through books or notes, she could identify as a letter, word, or glyph. Inside the gaudy gilt frame,
The outer edges of the silvery glass were marred with a cloudy, uneven black stain of some sort, but aside from that, the glass itself was startlingly clear. She suspected it had been broken and replaced at some point, and would ultimately prove centuries younger than the frame. No mirror of yore had achieved such clarity. Though the earliest artificial mirrors discovered by archaeologists dated back to 6200 BCE, they had been fashioned of polished obsidian, not glass. The first glass mirrors of significant size, roughly 3 by 5 foot panels, hadn't been manufactured until the 1680s by Italian glassmaker Bernard Perotto for the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, commissioned by the extravagant Sun King, Louis XIV. Exceptional glass mirrors of the size of the one before her, an impressive 6.5 feet tall, generally proved to be a few hundred years old at most. Considering this one's pristine silvering, it was likely less than a century in age, and no one had gone mad or died from slow mercury poisoning making it. Hatmakers, or hatters, hadn't been the only ones to suffer from the toxic fumes of their trade. Though for some reason Jesse'd never been able to figure, the idiom, mad as a mirror maker, had never quite caught on. Eyes narrowed thoughtfully, she scrutinized it. The archaeologist in her itched to know the piece's provenance, wondered if the frame had been accurately dated. She frowned. What did the professor want with a mirror anyway? Such an item wasn't at all in keeping with his usual tastes, which ran toward replica weapons and reproductions of ancient timepieces, such as the 16th-century German astrolabe adorning his desk. And how could the professor possibly afford something worth buku bucks on his teaching salary anyway? Fishing the key from the pocket of her jeans, she turned to leave. She'd done as he'd asked. Her work here was finished. She flipped off the light and was just stepping through the doorway when she felt a chill. All the fine hair at the nape of her neck lifted, tingling as if electrified. Her heart was abruptly pounding against the wall of her chest, and she felt the sudden, terrifying certainty that she was being watched, in the manner that prey was watched. Flinching, she turned back toward the mirror. Dimly illumined by the pale blue glow of the computer's screensaver, the artifact looked positively eerie. The gold appeared silvery, the silver glass smoky, dark, and deep with shadows. And in those shadows, something moved. She sucked in a breath so fast she choked on it. Sputtering, she groped for the light switch. Overhead light blazed down, flooding the room. She stared into the oblong glass, a hand pressed to her throat, swallowing convulsively. Her reflection stared back. After a moment, she closed her eyes, snapped them open, stared into the glass again. Just her. The hair at her nape continued to bristle. Icy chills rippled up her spine. The pulse at the hollow of her neck fluttered frantically beneath her palm. Eyes wide, she glanced uneasily around the room. The professor's office, precisely as it should be. After a long moment, she tried for a laugh, but it came out shaky, uncertain, and seemed to echo unpleasantly in the office, as if the room's square footage and actual occupiable space didn't quite coincide.
"Jesse, you're losing it," she whispered.
There was nothing, no one with her in the professor's office but her overactive imagination. With a dismissive toss of her head, she turned, flipped off the light again, and this time pulled the door shut behind her hard and fast and without a backward glance. Hurrying down the corridor, she dashed out into the back parking lot, kicking up a swirl of red and gold leaves as she hastened to her car. The more distance she put between herself and the building, the more ridiculous she felt. Really, getting all spooked alone on campus at night. One day, she would be working on excavations in the middle of nowhere, quite likely late at night and sometimes alone. She couldn't afford to be fanciful. At times, though, it was hard not to be, especially when holding a 2,500-year-old druid brooch, or examining a fabulously detailed Latin period sword. Certain relics seemed to carry lingering traces of energy, the residue of the passionate lives of those who'd touched them. Though not anything like what she thought she'd just seen.
"How weird was that?"
she muttered, shaking off a lingering shiver. God, I really must have sex on the brain.
Watching the hottie and his girlfriend earlier had apparently done quite a number on her. That, coupled with exhaustion and the low lighting, she decided firmly as she unlocked her car and slipped behind the wheel, must have pushed her over the edge into a brief, eyes-wide-open kind of hallucination fantasy. Because for a moment, she actually thought she'd seen a half-naked man, an absolute sex god of a man, no less, standing in Keene's office, looking back at her. A trick of the light. Strange shadows falling, nothing more. A towering, muscle-ripped, darkly beautiful man, dripping power, and hunger, and sex. The kind of sex nice girls didn't have.
Oh, honey, you so need to get a boyfriend.
Looking at her like she was Little Red Riding Hood and the big bad wolf hadn't been fed in a long, long time. Definitely a trick of the light. Looking at her from inside the mirror. In a place that was not a place, yet was place enough to serve as an inescapable fortress prison. A place to terrify, to drive the common man stark raving mad. 6 feet 5 inches of caged 9th-century Highlander stirred. A hungry animal sound rumbled deep in his throat. Just as he'd thought. He smelled woman. Chapter 2. A few days later. When next Jesse unlocked the professor's office, late on Monday night, a distant part of her brain noted something askew, some tiny niggling detail, but she failed to process it, as she was currently the guest of honor at her own festive and highly enthusiastic pity party. That she turned the key and back again, actually locking, then unlocking the door, eluded her utterly. Had she not been busy muttering beneath her breath about the depressingly huge stack of freshman papers that had been dumped on her in the professor's absence, that she might have actually gotten time to work on grading if he hadn't left her a message last night with a list a mile long of periodicals and sources he wanted her to collect from a dozen different places and bring to the hospital so he could flag notes for the book he was writing while laid up recuperating, she might have been cognizant enough of her surroundings to have reconsidered walking through the door. Maybe closed it again, locked it for real, and gone and gotten campus security. Unfortunately, enthused celebrant of her own misery, she didn't notice a thing. She paused with the door slightly ajar, puffed a few strands of hair from her face, and shifted the crammed full backpack on her shoulder so her textbooks would stop gouging the back of her ribs.
111 essays? Would somebody just shoot me and put me out of my misery?
She'd counted them in disbelief when Mark Trudeau, smirking openly, had handed them over. There went any hope of sleeping for the next few days.
Hey, I agreed to teach Keene's classes, Jess, and you know how tight my schedule is. He said you would grade.
She knew exactly why Keene had said she would grade. Because no doubt, Mark had called him over the weekend and suggested she grade. Mark had been a shit to her ever since last year, when he'd hit on her, unsuccessfully, at the department Christmas party. She couldn't stand men who talked to her breasts, as if there was nothing above them worth noting, and he was one of the worst. She didn't go around talking to men's crotches. Sure enough, the professor had left her another message while she was in class, bringing his total in the past 24 hours to 5. Would somebody please either take that man's phone away or knock him out with sedatives? And thanked her for being
such a lovely assistant and helping out. Mark really does have his hands full, and I told him you'd be happy to assist.
Right. As if anyone had given her a choice. And as if Mark's hands were any more full than hers. But the world of academia was, like the rest of the world in many ways, still an old boys' school, and any time Jesse began to forget that, life invariably gave her a refresher course. Nudging the door open with her hip, Jesse pushed inside, leaving it ajar. Skirting the desk, she headed straight for the wall of bookshelves.
She didn't bother turning on the light, partly because she'd organized the office herself and knew exactly where to find the two books on Celtic Gaul that Professor Keene wanted, and partly because she was determined not to get distracted by the mirror and the slow, relentless burn of questions it had ignited in her mind. She'd made peace with that weird little trick of the eye she'd suffered on Friday, a product of nothing more than low light and exhaustion. But she was dying to know if the mirror was a genuine relic. How had the professor come across it? Was its origin provable? Had any valid dating been done? What were those symbols, anyway? Jessie had a sticky memory, a useful ability in her field, and several of the symbols had gotten embedded in it from her single cursory inspection. She'd been subconsciously pondering them since, wondering why they seemed so familiar, yet somehow wrong, trying to pinpoint where she'd seen something similar before. Her specialty was the archaeology of Europe from the Paleolithic to the Celtic Iron Age. Though the mirror was clearly of recent manufacture, she was titillated by the possibility that the frame might actually date to somewhere in the late Iron Age. She knew herself well enough to know that if she took another look at the relic tonight, curiosity would get the best of her, and the next thing she'd be digging through the professor's reference books, trying to determine what the symbols were, and doing her best to guesstimate a date. "Been there, done that," she thought wryly. Blew an entire night without even realizing it, poring over one artifact or another, especially on those rare and glorious occasions the university was briefly entrusted with a collector's piece for study or verification. She always paid for it double the next day. With that infernal stack of papers waiting for her, she couldn't afford to waste any time. In and out, swift and efficient, was her plan, and she was sticking to it. She was just reaching up to pluck the two thick volumes from the shelf when she heard the soft snick of the door closing behind her. She stiffened, froze mid-reach, then snorted and pulled the first book from the shelf. A draft, nothing more.
"No way. I am not getting all freaked out on campus again tonight. That blasted mirror is just a mirror," she told the bookcase firmly.
"Actually, it's not," a smooth, faintly accented voice murmured behind her. "It's far more than a mere mirror. Who else knows it's here?"
Jessie gasped and turned around so fast that the book went flying from her hand, hit the wall with a solid whump, and slid to the floor. She winced. The professor was going to kill her if she'd spindled the spine. He was funny about his books, especially his hardbacks. Across the office, in the dim light afforded by the computer, she could just make out the silhouette of a man leaning back against the door, his arms folded across his chest.
"What? Who?"
she stammered. Light flooded the room.
"I startled you,"
the man said softly, dropping his hand from the wall switch. Later, Jessie would realize he'd merely noted a fact, not apologized. She blinked against the abrupt increase in wattage, taking him in. His arms were crossed again. He leaned casually against the door. Tall and well-built, he was extremely attractive. Longish blonde hair was pulled back from a clean-shaven classic face. He wore a dark, expensive tailored suit, a crisp shirt, a tasteful tie. His accent held distinct Slavic undertones, perhaps Russian, she mused. A young professor visiting from abroad, a speaker engaged by the university.
"I didn't realize anyone else was still in this wing," she said. "Are you looking for Professor Keene?"
"The professor and I have already had our time together this evening,"
he replied with the ghost of a smile. An odd way of phrasing things. His comment passed through her mind absently, as she was still hung up on his opening gambit. She pounced on it, pursuing it eagerly.
"What did you mean it's far more than a mere mirror? What do you know about it? Where is it from? Are you here to authenticate it, or has it already been? What are the symbols, do you know?"
He stepped away from the door, moved deeper into the room.
"I understand it was delivered this past Friday. Has anyone else seen it?"
Jessie thought a moment, shook her head.
"I don't think so. The deliveryman opened it up, but other than that, just me. Why?"
He glanced around the office.
There's been no cleaning crew in since then. No other persons such as yourself with the key.
Jesse frowned, perplexed by the direction of his questions, and getting irked that he wasn't answering any of hers.
No, the cleaners come on Wednesdays, and the only reason I have a key is because I'm Professor Keene's assistant.
I see. He eased forward another step, and that was when Jesse felt it. Menace, rolling off him. She'd not picked up on it right away, disarmed by his good looks, curious about the artifact, peripherally distracted by her own brooding. But it was there, a wolf beneath the sheep's clothing. For all his seeming civility, there was something cold and dangerous beneath that elegant suit, and it was focused on her. Why? It didn't make any sense. And suddenly, the tiny niggling detail that had eluded her when she'd turned the key in the door swam up from the murky waters of her subconscious. It had already been unlocked. He must have been inside the office, concealing himself behind the door when she'd pushed it open. Keep him talking, she thought, fighting panic. She drew a careful, deep breath. Adrenaline was kicking in, upping her heart rate, making her hands and legs feel shaky. She concentrated on betraying no sign of her belated recognition of danger. Surprise might be the only advantage she had. Somewhere in the office was something she could use as a weapon, something more threatening than a book. She just had to get her hands on it before he figured out she was on to him. She snatched a surreptitious glance to her right. Yes, just as she'd thought, there lay one of the professor's replica blades on a nearby curio table. Though a reproduction piece, fashioned of steel, not gem-encrusted gold, it was every bit as lethal as the real thing.
So, how old is the mirror anyway?
She asked, donning her best, wide-eyed, I'm-not-the-brightest-bulb-in-the-box look. He moved again, smooth, like a well-muscled animal. A few more steps and he'd be past the desk. She eased right a tad. It seemed he was pondering whether or not to answer her for a moment. Then he shrugged.
You would probably place it in the old Stone Age.
Jesse sucked in a breath, and for just a moment, the briefest of instants, fear fell by the wayside. The old Stone Age? Was he kidding? Wait, of course he was. He had to be. It was patently impossible. The earliest forms of writing, cuneiform and hieroglyphics, weren't even in existence until the mid to end of the 4th century BCE. And those etchings on the mirror were some kind of writing.
Ha ha, I'm not that stupid.
Well, today, she seated dismally, she certainly seemed to be, on just about all fronts. But normally she wasn't. Normally she suffered only one or two stupid fronts, not this all-encompassing blanket idiocy.
That would put it at pre-10,000 BCE,
she scoffed as she stole a few more inches. Had he noticed what she was doing? If so, he was giving no indication.
Yes, indeed it would. Considerably pre.
He took another step forward. She considered screaming, but she was nearly certain there was no one else in the south wing this late at night, and she suspected it would be wiser to conserve her energy to defend herself with.
Okay, I'll go with this a minute,
she said, inching, inching. Just a little farther. Keep him talking. Dare she make a leap for it?
You're claiming the frame is from the old Stone Age, right? And the carvings were added later and the mirror inserted in the last century or so?
No. The entire piece, in sum, old Stone Age.
Her jaw dropped. She snapped her mouth closed, but it fell open again. She searched his face, detected no sign of jest.
Impossible. Symbols aside, that's a glass mirror.
He laughed softly.
Not quite. Nothing about an unseely piece is ever quite what it seems.
An unseely piece?
She echoed blankly.
I'm not familiar with that classification.
Her fingers curled. She braced herself to dive for the blade, doing a mental 5 count. 4. 3.
Not many are. It denotes relics few ever see and live to tell of. ancient hallows fashioned by those darkest among the Tuatha De Dananna. He paused the space of a heartbeat.
Don't worry, Jessica St. James.
Oh God, he knew her name. How did he know her name?
I'll make it quick. You'll hardly feel a thing.
His smile was terrifyingly gentle.
Holy shit!
She lunged for the dirk at the same moment he lunged for her. When one was afraid for one's life, Jesse observed with almost serene, dreamlike detachment, events had a funny way of slowing down, even though one knew events were really rushing toward one with all the velocity and surety of a high-speed train wreck. She noted every detail of his lunge as if it unfolded in freeze frames. His legs bent. His body drew in on itself, coiling to spring. One hand dipped into a pocket, withdrew a thin wire with leather-wrapped ends. His eyes went cold, his face hard. She even noticed the whitening around the edges of his nostrils as they flared with a terrifying, incongruous sexual excitement. She was aware of her own body in a similar dichotomous fashion. Though her heart thundered and her breath came in fast and furious gasps, her legs felt made of lead, and the few steps she managed seemed to take a lifetime. His lips curled mockingly, and in that sharp-edged smile, she saw the sudden, stark certainty that even if she managed to arm herself with the small blade, it wouldn't matter. Death waited in his smile. He'd done this before, many, many times, and he was good at it. She had no idea how she knew, she just knew. As he closed in on her, wrapping the leather-cased ends of the wire around his hands, the silvery glint of the mirror, leaning against the bookshelves beyond the table, caught her eye. Of course. The mirror. She might not be able to best him in a physical struggle, but she just happened to be smack between him and what he wanted. And what he wanted was highly breakable. She practically fell on top of the curio table, shoved aside the dirk, and closed her hand instead around the heavy pewter base of the lamp next to it. She whirled to face him at dizzying speed, backed up against the mirror, and hefted the lamp like a baseball bat.
Stop right there!
He stopped so abruptly that he should have fallen flat on his face, which spoke volumes about how much lethal muscle was under that suit. Oh yes, she'd be dead if he got his hands on her.
Take one more step, and I'll smash the mirror to smithereens!
She brandished the lamp threateningly. Was that the sound of a sharply indrawn breath behind her, followed by a muttered curse? Impossible. She dare not turn, dare not take her eyes off her attacker for even a moment, dare not give in to the sob of fear that was trying to claw its way up the back of her throat. His gaze darted over her shoulder, his eyes flared, then his gaze latched back on her.
No, you won't. You preserve history, you don't destroy it. That thing is priceless, and it is as old as I said it was. It is conceivably the single most important relic any archaeologist has ever laid eyes on. It debunks thousands of years of your so-called history. Think of the impact it could have on your world.
Mine, personally? Gee, like a nun, if I'm dead. Back off, mister, if you want it in one piece. And I think you do. I think it's not worth the thing to you, broken.
If he was going to kill her, she had nothing to lose by smashing it into a gazillion silvery little pieces, no matter that her inner historian violently protested such sacrilege. If she was going down, she was taking whatever he wanted with her. If she was going to be dead, by God, he was going to be miserable too. A muscle worked in his jaw. His gaze skidded between her and the mirror and back again. He tensed as if to take a step.
Don't do it!
She warned.
I'm serious!
She shifted her grip on the lamp, prepared to swing it into the mirror if he so much as breathed wrong. If nothing else, maybe they'd struggle atop the shards of glass. He'd slip, cut himself, and bleed to death. One never knew.
Impasse, he murmured. Interesting. You've more spirit than I thought.
If you are wishing to live, lass,
came the deep, rich purr of a brogue behind her.
Best summon me out now.
A chill shuddered through her entire body, and the baby-fine hair at the nape of her neck stood up, quivering on end. Just like on Friday, the room felt suddenly wrong, not quite the size and shape it was supposed to be, as if a door that by all conventions of reality couldn't possibly be there had suddenly opened, skewing the known dimensions of her world.
"Shut the hell up!"
her assailant clipped, his gaze fixed over her shoulder.
"Or I'll smash you myself!"
Dark, mocking laughter rolled behind her. It made her shiver.
"You wouldn't dare, and well you can it. 'Tis why you've not rushed her. Lucan sent you with precise instructions. Bring it back intact, nay. The mere possibility that the mirror might be shattered makes your blood ice. You know what he'd do to you. You'd be begging for death."
"Ha! No way!"
Jessie whispered, eyes going wide. She could feel the blood draining from her face, knew she'd gone white as snow.
"Not believing this..."
She took a shaky little breath.
"Any of this..."
Logic insisted there couldn't possibly be anyone behind her, and certainly not anyone inside a mirror, for heaven's sake. But her gut was of a different opinion. Her gut sensed man, with a capital M behind her, and he was throwing off all the heat of a small fiery forge at her back, enough that it made the sides in front of her feel abruptly cold, made her neck ache with the effort of keeping her gaze fixed firmly on her would-be murderer and not turning to gape at the looking-glass. She could feel him behind her. Something. Someone. Caged power. Caged sexuality. Whatever was behind her was formidable.
"Do not turn, woman."
He. It. Whatever it was, counseled.
"Keep your eyes on him, and speak after me."
"I'd advise against that,"
the blonde man warned, locking gazes with her.
"You've no idea what you'd be letting out of that mirror."
Jessie took another shallow breath. She could sense the blonde man's tightly leashed fury, knew if he thought for even a split second that she might not actually break the mirror, she was dead. She was afraid to so much as blink, afraid he would lunge during that brief moment of vulnerability. And there was something behind her that couldn't possibly be there, at least not according to any laws of physics she understood. Admittedly, there were many laws of physics she didn't understand. But she felt confident enough of those she did to protest faintly,
"This is crazy."
"Crazy would be letting him out,"
the blonde man said.
"Step away from the mirror."
"Do as I say, and I'll see to it that he doesn't harm you."
"Oh, like I'm believing that. Now you're my protector?"
"Summon me out, woman. I am your protector,"
came the command at her back.
"This isn't happening."
It couldn't be. None of it. Her mind was incapable of processing it, and the sensation of dreamlike detachment was increasing exponentially. She felt as if she were standing, bewildered on a stage set, as actors played their parts around her, and if somebody had a playbill with one of those helpful little plot synopsis thingies, she sure hadn't gotten to see it.
"He will kill you, lass,"
rolled the deep Scottish burr behind her.
"And you know it. You'd then ken the same of me. Sure death, or mayhap death, 'tis a simple choice."
"And that's supposed to be reassuring?"
She snapped over her shoulder, to whatever it was that was there that couldn't really be there. The blonde man smiled coldly.
"Oh, he'll kill you, and far more brutally than I. Step aside and I'll let you live. I'll collect the mirror and leave. I give you my word."
Jessie shook her head from side to side once.
"Leave, now, and I won't smash the mirror."
"He won't leave, lass, till you're dead. He cannot. He is bound to serve one who would punish him were he to leave you alive now that you've seen the dark glass. I've no means to convince you to trust me. You must hang your bonnet on faith. Him or me. Choose now."
He was imprisoned in such a fashion because he is a ruthless killer that couldn't be contained any other way. He was locked away for the safety of the world. He took the power of the formidable druids.
Woman, choose! Repeat this. Leoth Bre Chibre, Kian McKelter, Drachme Seshi.
Jessie echoed the strange words without missing a beat the moment she heard them, because she finally understood what was going on. She was right. None of this was happening. What was happening was that she'd let herself in Professor Keene's office, and rather than going to the bookshelf as she'd thought, she'd sat down for a moment on the plush leather Chesterfield sofa to rest her eyes. But she'd ended up getting too horizontal, and she was currently snoozing soundly away, having the most bizarre of dreams. And everyone knew nothing mattered in dreams. One always woke up. Always. So why not let the man out of the mirror? Who cared? She echoed the odd incantation twice for good measure. Brilliant golden light flashed, the heat behind her increased markedly, and the room suddenly seemed too small for all that was in it. The sensation of spatial distortion increased almost unbearably. The lamp was plucked from her limp grasp and placed elsewhere. Strong hands closed on her waist from behind, lifted her from the floor and swept her aside, deposited her behind him, sheltering her with his body. She caught a scent of him then. God, had she ever smelled such a scent? The female muscles deep in her lower belly clenched. He bore no chemical traces of aftershave or deodorant, nothing artificial, just pure man, a blend of sun-warmed leather on skin, a kiss of something spicy like clove, a touch of sweat, and the raw, unspoken promise of sex. If male sexual dominion had a scent, he reeked of it. And it worked on her like the ultimate pheromone, bringing her nipples and groin to intense, painful sexual awareness. She glanced up. And up. It was the same towering, gorgeous, muscle-ripped man from her Friday night fantasy, his long, dark hair a tangle of dozens of braids bound with gold, silver, and copper beads, falling halfway down his back. His bare, oh-so-beautiful velvet-skinned back.
Whoa,
she breathed. In all her voyeuristic forays, she'd never seen a man so savagely, splendidly masculine. Figured he existed only in her subconscious. It occurred to her then that since it was her subconscious at work, it was high time she transformed her id's twisted little everyone's-trying-to-kill-Jessie-today dream into something more to her liking. One toe-curling, scorchingly hot sex dream. Usually, even the most intractable of bad dreams needed only a tiny nudge. Nudge she would. With this fantasy man, happily, blissfully even, she slid her palms up that perfect, powerful back, gliding over the ridges of muscle. Fisted her hands in all that magnificent dark hair. Rubbed up against him, molding herself like saran wrap to his muscular, deliciously tight ass. And licked him. Slipped her tongue right up his spine, tasted the salt and man and heat of him. His entire body jerked with a violence that she would have found frightening were she awake and any of it real. He sucked in a sharp breath between his teeth, a long, tight, indrawn hiss, as if he were in exquisite pain. He went completely still and made a guttural sound deep in his throat.
"You try me, woman,"
he hissed. He tossed his head, hard, yanking his braids free of her hands. In two strides he was through the door, slamming it behind him. Only then did Jessie realize her assailant, too, was gone. He must have fled the moment she'd freed the man from the mirror. With a gusty sigh, she went and slumped down on the couch. After a moment, she lay down, stretched out, and folded her arms behind her head. She crossed her legs, uncrossed them, rubbed her eyes, pinched herself experimentally a time or two. God, she was horny. She couldn't remember ever being so horny. The instant she'd pressed up against him, she'd felt the strangest, well, jolt, for lack of a better word, sizzle through her entire body,
and she'd gotten instantly ready. Panties slick, ready for sex, no foreplay necessary, ready. So, this is a wet dream, she thought with a little snort of amusement. A worrisomely vivid, detailed wet dream, but a dream nonetheless. She was going to wake up any minute now. Yep, any minute now. Chapter 3 Jesse awakened stiff, cold, and with the beginnings of what promised to be a perfectly vicious headache. Her neck was crinked from sleeping funny, and she must have pushed her pillow off the bed in the middle of the night, because there was nothing remotely downy beneath her head. She opened her eyes and pushed herself up, intending to take some Advil, retrieve her pillow, and lie back down for a few minutes. But the moment she opened her eyes, she had to add, utterly perplexed as to her current location in the universe, to her list of complaints. Unfortunately, her cranky, sleep-muddled respite from reality was far too brief. As soon as she sat up, she discovered she was not in her bed as she'd thought, but on the sofa in Professor Keene's office, and the events of last night sledgehammered back into her brain. Groaning, she dropped her head forward and clutched it with both hands. Impossible events. A stranger in the office who'd